Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hey, welcome to the Apparatus Architects, our podcast this month. We're recording live and in person at the Firehouse Expo here in Baltimore. And Brother Mike and I, starting out, going to have a couple of programs here over the course of the next couple of days. So what we're going to talk about a little bit this month is where are we failing at apparatus design? As our industry show trade season is in full swing right now, and no matter where you are geographically in the United States, probably you can drive a couple hundred miles in any one direction and find a trade show, even if it's a local county or state-run activity where people, different apparatus manufacturers, are having their latest products that in some cases are stock models or demonstrators to show their capabilities. In other cases, they are units that have a department's name on the side. But as Mike and I are finding, at least with a good majority of our work being East Coast related, we're casual observers, or as a good friend said the other evening, students of the fire service. So whether your vocation is in technical rescue or hazardous materials or any aspect of the fire service, it's important to keep our talents up to speed by availing ourselves of conferences such as what's going on now at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, with a virtually a worldwide group of noted fire service instructors and people who have a lot of experience in many different areas. So in the area of apparatus, where Mike and I at least pretend to spend part of our time, we've noticed some, I think, pretty strategic, in some cases bordering on massive failures in terms of how the apparatus looks once it's produced. Now, I want to have a little caveat here. We're not damning or criticizing the manufacturers that built these vehicles. In many cases, particularly in combination or volunteer departments, our apparatus committees are made up of a cross-section of individuals with different backgrounds and experiences. And as Mike and I have preached previously, as the size of that committee grows, so do the ideas that want to get incorporated on the fire truck. And unfortunately, the end result is we're not sure whether we've got a cake or a pie, or even if we're even in the bakery. So with that, we want to follow up. And again, no hard and fast rules here, but just some passing thoughts on that, Michael. So the first one that I came up with was called the fire station syndrome. So lest you click off this podcast and think that this doesn't impact your apparatus, listen to Brother Mike here. We're going to have a few words of wisdom from him on what we are now going to call the fire station syndrome that impacts apparatus design.
Thank you, Brother Tom. On some recent fleet evaluations that we've done, and then even more recent to that, measuring a fire station to make sure that the new fire apparatus was going to fit, came up with this new syndrome, that this affliction that we have in the fire service. And what we have decided to do, it would seem, is to take and specify a truck that will fill up the station.
Now, Mike, this applies to engines too here. We got to keep this fair and balanced, correct?
Well, truck meaning, yes, that the apparatus, and not necessarily a ladder company, but yes, all kinds of apparatus, whether they be engine apparatus or truck apparatus or rescue apparatus or special units or wildland urban interface, but we seem to be taking the available base space and making a truck that will fill up the space with literally feet, sometimes inches to spare, walking around the vehicle. That's of particular interest when you go to do your daily or weekly truck check and there's hardly enough room to open the compartment doors if you have de-handled doors, or let alone get the equipment out of the equipment trays and try to check anything or try to test it, it becomes problematic at best because there's just simply not enough room. And when you go to a department and you evaluate the fleet, and they have four units, and each unit, it appeared that the department got the Visa Gold Card from whomever to purchase these rigs and basically just built them as big, high, tall, wide, heavy as they could to fit the available space. And they not only did that one time in this department, but they basically did it five times.
Mike, with respect to the fire station syndrome, I guess there's two sides of this. We have observed, as well as work with departments that have designed a piece of apparatus working with a noted and qualified apparatus salesperson, and then asked them, well, obviously they haven't built this rig for you yet, but have you had the opportunity to bring in a vehicle, even if it was a different color and wasn't even the style of unit that you were looking for necessarily, but have you brought a unit into your community of at least plus or minus a couple inches each way, a wheelbase and an overall length and an overall height? The number one, confirm it fits the firehouse. And a lot of times you just get a blank stare saying, well, we had a demonstrator come in and he pulled it up on a ramp and then we looked at it in the parking lot. Well, did you put it in the fire station? No. Did you take that rig and drive it around in the community to find out how it turned and maneuvered and as compared to your existing vehicle, where, you know, how did it work? I know several years ago when one of the manufacturers were heavily promoting the rear steer option on aerial apparatus. I know personally there were several departments in the New York area that were operating tractor-drawn ladders where the challenge was, okay, you take your tractor-drawn out and you lead out and take us through your community and put it in the tightest areas that you normally have to operate within, and we'll see how our rear steer device works and if it can access the same areas equally, if not more easily, than your tractor-drawn ladder. All right, and that kind of makes sense, particularly when you're looking at something of that size and that significance. Every year, you'll hear several occasions, but typically they're not publicized. If you have a community that's got one of those electronic billboard signs in front of the firehouse, and they'll put different fire prevention messages up, or if they're having different other local public service events that they're advertising to the community, you don't see those signs ever light up and said, we just bought a 2015 whatever and we don't like it. We just bought a 2014 whatever and it didn't fit the firehouse. Those things tend to get swept under the rug. So the fire station syndrome is just one of those things where we seem to be not concerned about making the replacement vehicle incrementally larger than the one we're replacing. We just think that it's somehow going to work out, and if it fits the firehouse, everything else is going to be fine. So that then leads us to the next point. The result of this fire station syndrome in most cases ends up lending itself that if you take your replacement vehicle and when the new one shows up at the dedication of the new unit or the housing, you put the two of those things side by side in the fire station parking lot, it almost looks like, in some cases we've observed, you've got a matchbox toy as the existing unit, and the new replacement unit looks like something that you supersized it. Now, we've had folks that have claimed, no problem here, we have all truck drivers in our department. Well, if you are fortunate enough to have people that have all CDLs that are used to driving heavily laden and loaded Class 8 vehicles up and down the road. God bless you. You're probably in the minority. And even if that's the snapshot of what the station looks like today, look at the age of some of those people. If your fire truck is something that gets replaced every 15, 18, maybe 20 years in some of the older communities where they've got larger number of units and fleets and everybody's pretty much on a rotational basis. So if you own or operate a 1994 pumper, you kind of know that the guy that owned operated the 1992 truck, he got a new vehicle in 2014. You're thinking, okay, in a year or so, plus or minus, if the money holds up in our community, we're going to be up. Well, 15 to 18 to 20 years from now are those, that cadre of group of folks who have CDLs, who are well-experienced, that drive dump trucks or mixers or whatever, or work for the local highway department and are used to operating snow plows and are very mechanically inclined. Again, you're in the minority. Are those people going to be around at the 10 or 12-year mark when the unit's at its half-life, and you now find out you've got a group of folks who are just not comfortable with driving something that big? So too large, too heavy. The other aspect is, as we have pleaded with folks over the course of many of our past podcasts, Mike, this results in overweight rigs. And what's the reaction when we come into town and say, have you ever weighed your apparatus? They say no. They're fortunate enough to have a local either transfer station or a sand and gravel pit, or in some cases are brought in the local arm of the state police or local police if they're so equipped with scales. They weigh their vehicles, and then they find out, oh, my God, here's where we're at.
What can we do then as a group to maybe alleviate some of these problems? One of the things that we recommend is, as you are seeking out new apparatus and you engage salespeople, that you hold the salespeople's feet to the fire and make them bring in a like and kind vehicle to the one that you're going to expect delivery of. In other words, if you are specking out something that's a 235-inch wheelbase and it's going to be 10 foot tall and 35 feet long, then that same kind of truck needs to be demonstrated within your first due to make sure that it's actually going to work. And in all fairness, what the apparatus committee should do is develop a list of potentially a half a dozen to maybe even a dozen spots within the first due that you may think of as being problematic getting in and out of, which could start right off with the firehouse. A, is it going to fit? B, is it going to be able to get out and get back into the fire station in one swing? Without having to constantly back up and pull forward because there's just not enough space for it. And so you're going to develop these sites, and then you may engage three or four different manufacturers. And again, you need to have them bring in like and kind vehicles that you're thinking about buying in the same height and size and wheelbase ratio that you're thinking about buying. And then have them demonstrate each one and take them to all the same sites so that we judge everybody equally and fairly. This is particularly important when you get into larger vehicles like aerials or towers. You may find specific places within your first due that nobody will be able to get there, and you want to note that. And then obviously if you have a number of places where what you're thinking about purchasing isn't going to fit, well, then that takes the apparatus committee back to the drawing board and maybe need to reevaluate the type and kind of aerial unit that you actually want to purchase.
Mike, and that's a great point. There are several departments, and not that we're picking on this particular design, but this is, I think, pretty much a good case study. A department that we were working with a number of years ago that was replacing a 18-year-old engine that was pretty traditional for that time period, was equipped reasonably short wheelbase, had high side compartments on the driver's side, had low side compartments with standard mount exposed ground ladders. And the committee had decided, we want more compartment space. So they were going to do full-height compartments on both sides of the body with a hydraulic ladder rack. Now, they were fortunate in that community. They had a ladder company that was housed in another station, but it was a very, very tight community with innumerable one-way streets, and virtually every street in town permitted parking on both sides of the road. So one of the demonstrator rigs that they brought in from a vendor of a product that they were considering was equipped that way. And we just suggested that as they were out driving in the community, to go to Mike's point, as you're going into these places to see if the apparatus fits, just stop in a couple of locations and deploy the ladder rack and see if the ladder rack can safely be deployed based on its operating characteristics, so that if you needed, as an engine company, to utilize the ground ladders off it, you could do that. And after they did that a couple of times, they came back in a follow-up email. They said, Mike and Tom, thanks for the suggestion, because we found out that in virtually most of the residential area of our response district, wasn't an issue in the commercial district, but in a residential area, based on the spotting of the engine company, there was not enough room to deploy the ladder rack without being on somebody's front porch or customizing somebody's car that was parked on the opposite side of the street. So lesson learned here. They talked themselves out of the ladder rack, and we modified the compartment design on the officer's side on the right side and came up with a different mechanism for the ground ladder. So it's interesting. It seems to me, Mike, that whether we're talking about the size of the vehicle or our next topic when we just talk about cab layout and how many people we want to put in versus how much tools of equipment, there's almost two completely diverse viewpoints and nobody in the middle. There's either the folks that realize we need short maneuverable apparatus and our engine doesn't need to be a technical rescue engine, a rescue wagon, a rescue pumper. We need a pumper, and it's got to be as short as possible to get around the district. And yes, I know I got a 63-foot long apparatus bay. I'm not looking to buy a 38-foot long pumper, because I got to get around in my community and I got to make it work. And there's nobody in the middle between that, and we don't frankly care how damn big we make it. We've convinced ourselves that this is what we need, and we've had cases where the unit wheelbase and overall lengthwise is 3 or 3.5 feet longer, and the people on paper, by looking at a blueprint, have somehow mystically convinced themselves not an issue. And so far, based on our casual observations, we haven't found too many people in the middle of the road. The people that know they need a short rig, it's perfectly obvious to them. And when we work with those folks, it's frankly a lot easier to design something. It's almost like going into a house, you know, and saying, you know, right away how many bedrooms, baths, and how much storage room I need, versus somebody that just says, here's, I got an acre and a half, and I think my budget is X, so I'm going to make this house as big as I can. All right, and then I'll kind of worry about it later on. Your thoughts?
Well, a couple issues come to mind here. One, the reason in many cases that departments are putting everything in a kitchen sink, particularly on an engine or a Quint, is due to the lack of staffing. And we've said it before on this program, and we'll say it again, you cannot fix a staffing issue by buying a screwed-up fire truck. It just simply doesn't work, okay? If you have a staffing issue, whether you're a career department or volunteer department, you need to fix the staffing issue, okay? Get your head out of the sand and fix the staffing issue. By buying these all-in-one, all-purpose vehicles that are too big, too heavy, too high, too long, that can't get around half your community, isn't serving anybody very well at all. It adds to more money in the original purchase cost, and that it adds further in maintenance costs when you try to keep this thing on the road in its 10 or 15 or 20-year respective lifespan, whatever the authority having jurisdiction has deemed the life cycle of this vehicle to be. The second thing to keep in mind, and this kind of came up yesterday in discussions, Some of the apparatus speccing goes awry because of the knowledge of individuals seated at the table. And part of this lack of knowledge can be on the side of the apparatus committee, and the other part of the lack of knowledge is on the sales side. Many salespeople are part-time. Some of them are very, very good and have a lot of product knowledge, and some of them are new or not very good and have limited product knowledge. And so you have a confluence here. If you have an apparatus committee, and we've worked with folks like this before, where there are six or seven members and they've never purchased a fire truck, and they happen to be sitting across from somebody that was a salesman that sold used cars 4 months ago and now decides that they want to try fire trucks, this is a disaster in the making. And there's basically, once you get started in this process and you're sitting around the table and nobody has a clue, the end result is going to be predictable and it's not going to be very good. And you as listeners, just go around either to your own department or three departments in any given direction, and you will find somebody that has a fire truck that they've purchased within the last 5 years, and they absolutely hate it. Part of it could be, in fact, the doing of the apparatus salesman. Part of it could be the doing of the apparatus committee itself, or in part it could be due to both parties. But in any event... unlike a car, where if you don't like it in 4 or 5 years, you turn it all around and get rid of it and get something new. For most fire trucks, you're in it for the long haul, and the mistake that you make today is going to haunt you 10, 15, 20, sometimes 25 years later.
Point well taken, Mike. And then this rolls into the next thing, which impacts crew safety, how people are seated and how you operate, all right? And while we can't sit here as apparatus architects and tell you how to operate and deploy your apparatus, for departments that are still insistent on buying the longest or largest cab from measurement of the front cab sheet metal to the rear of the cab, with the thought being that we need to have seating for 7, 8, 9, or 10 personnel, all right? I have to say that in the last 4 to 5 years, it has been an extremely rare department that Mike and I have observed or worked with where they had an 8 or 10-person cab, meaning that there were 8 or 10 seats in there that actually could staff that unit on any night other than a meeting night or a training night at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Thursday, on the day that we're recording this podcast. They may be lucky to get 3 or 4 folks, all right? So why are we buying the biggest, largest cab with the greatest number of seats for that minimal occasion when we might have enough people to put on it? Because that directly impacts then the cost of the vehicle, your front axle loading, and safety concerns that for those folks that are still insistent, even if you had seating for 6, and we've seen several of these, where because of the change in deployment or services rendered by the department, we now are putting EMS cabinets or storage cabinets in the cab, and we've seen a number of units where we're putting those in what traditionally would be the outboard rear-facing seating positions behind the driver and officer, and now that leaves us then having 4 seats abreast, and this will go into the very last topic we talk about today, and then wondering why people don't utilize their seatbelts, or while people are complaining that we're crowded and cramped in the cab. So the next replacement vehicle, guess what? We ask the salesperson, what's the largest cab you buy that you offer? And we buy that. And right away, we've got anywhere from an 8 to, in some cases, a 16-inch longer vehicle from the get-go, because we have convinced ourselves we need more room in the cab for all this stuff that we want to put in there. And that takes us to the next issue, with respect to what is the mission of the vehicle and what equipment do we want to carry. I have to tell you that, sadly, of the number of communities where Michael and I have either been engaged to do work on for a fleet survey or to work on the design of a replacement apparatus, and out of the gate, the first thing we'll ask people is, do you have a written equipment inventory? It doesn't necessarily need to be by compartment, although that's kind of nice, of what this vehicle is going to carry, and they'll invariably say, well, it's going to carry what we have on the current vehicle. All right, so I had this experience within the last couple of weeks. People had we had worked with earlier to do a combination unit. Now we're replacing it. It's an engine-for-engine swap. We say, okay, so we're looking at, is there any option to make this unit smaller? Because now it's going to be an engine. It's not going to be a combination unit. And a couple of folks we work with say, well, Tom, it's going to carry everything that's on the engine downstairs that was at 19 years old. So we go downstairs, open up every compartment, and I start taking pictures. All right. Then we go back and look at each compartment and I say, okay, in this compartment, it's got this, this, and this. Is the D&E items going in another engine? Oh, no, absolutely not. We're going to get rid of that. We're not going to buy new, and it's going to go down a road with the existing engine. All right, and this happened to be some large, from a volume standpoint, some fairly sizable pieces of equipment. Didn't weigh a whole lot, but it's going to take a lot of space. And we do that in a few other compartments. Well, then when we get right down to the nitty-gritty, we find out really only about 70% of what the engine downstairs is carrying is going to get transferred over to the new unit. So the next logical question is, well, what do you not have today that you might be buying in the future to kind of fill this thing up so we can intelligently lay out the equipment? And the long and the short of it is, while the people were well-intended, they really didn't have a good handle as to what exactly was going to go on to the onto the new fire truck. So, again, that goes to two extremes. There are, in some communities, because of the lack of a qualified maintenance and an equipment budget, sometimes if they don't buy it new on a vehicle, you're not getting anything new for the next 18 or 19 years. And there's other cases where you're just saying, we're buying everything new, and we've got to have a brand new equipment inventory. So these things all interrelate to the size of the vehicle, the weight of the vehicle, the safety factor, what the unit's going to weigh once you put the thing in service. And again, the onus is on us, the people buying the apparatus. If we don't tell the manufacturer what we're putting on it and what the weight of it is, they're going to defer to the NFPA 1901 standard, which is fine, but that is a minimum. And we can assure you, based on a number of overweight vehicles that Brother Mike and I have come across, all shapes, sizes, colors, and manufacturers, all right, if we don't tell the people how many folks we plan on having live in our house and we build an inadequate number of bedrooms and bathrooms, the onus is on us. We messed up, not them.
Brother Shan, I learned something the other day about us as firefighters. As firefighters, we have many things in common. Strong A-type in-charge personalities, I think everybody would agree. We are all, as a group, risk-takers, or we wouldn't be doing what we do and diving into burning buildings. Another attribute that we seem to possess is that we're into instant gratification. You go to a fire, you put wet stuff on the red stuff, you get your jollies. You go to a pin job, you unpin somebody, instant gratification. You go to a cardiac, you zap them back to life. Life is good. And that's the life of a firefighter. But I learned something within the past couple months that we also have in common. And it's kind of a, if you look at it, it's true, and it's kind of a dirty little secret. Brother Shan, we are all hoarders.
No, come on.
We are hoarders. We don't get rid of anything.
You mean those compartments that I opened up a couple of weeks ago and stuff fell off at my feet? That was hoarding?
That was hoarding.
Oh,
yes, sir,
okay.
It was. And the one of the reasons why we need to buy a bigger fire truck this time than we had last time is because we refuse to look at our inventory and throw anything out for fear that we might someday use it, although in the past 20-year life of the truck we're replacing, we never did. You never know. And so we have this mentality, this attitude, this culture that, you know, just like, why are we buying a 10-man cab? Well, because back in 72 on meet night, we had to leave a couple guys behind. So we're never going to do that again. So we're going to be buy the biggest, most seats that we can, so that if that ever happens again, we've done all that we can physically to make sure we can accommodate as many on the truck as we can. And so we have this hoarding. When you go to a fire truck and you see a Cooper hose jacket, it kind of lends you to believe that we haven't looked at our inventory. So a good way to approach buying new apparatus is not just to take the equipment from the old one and immediately throw it on a new one and then build the new one bigger to add more stuff, but rather let's take an inventory of equipment on our old piece and kind of dissect it to the point of, well, have we ever used this, or when did we use it last, and how many times have we used it, and do we really need to take up room on the fire truck with this particular piece of equipment, and kind of do that forensic evaluation of each piece, understanding that a fire truck, you take, for instance, a $1.2 million ladder truck. If you take the square footage of compartment space and divide it by the cost of the truck, it represents some of the most expensive real estate on the face of the earth. You could go to the local mall and rent space per square foot cheaper than what you are going to pay for compartment space on your next fire truck. And so with that in mind, as a cautionary tale here, we need to be extraordinarily vigilant as to what we take off the old piece and put on the new piece, and then how much additional room we're going to require for any growth.
Mike, all great points, and that brings us up to our last subject that we very near and dear to our hearts, and particularly to Mike, who has just done yeoman service in this area, has to do with safety with respect to cab seating and seat belts. And for those listeners that have not really kind of followed this topic area, as you may have observed, there has been a slight but very modest change in the design of some of the seating configurations that we now have available to us in fire apparatus to make our ability to arrive at the scene, get back to the station, and be safe within the cab environment. If you think about, since 2009, it's been an NFPA requirement that all cabs, fire truck cabs, be crash tested. And I think that has somehow lulled us into a false sense of security that if we've purchased a unit that had rollover stability, that had airbag protection, that we know everyone's custom fire truck cab produced since January 1st of 2009 has had to be crash tested, it's that it's made us a little bit more invulnerable to being injured. And it's still okay to roll around with the windows down, our arms hanging out the window, no seat belts on, in various states of readiness to take in the next run or to go to the run. And with some of the work that Mike has done that is ultimately decided here at an NFPA level, because, again, that's the standard that all the manufacturers have to design to from a minimum, we're going to have Mike just update us on some very, very recent efforts that he and several other fire service folks have done to put together that moving forward, it's still a long road, but moving forward, there is, as they say, from a positive standpoint, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and it's not a fire truck coming at us in the other direction.
Thank you, Tom. Recently made a trip to Chicago as part of the NFPA conference, and we had made the NFPA Apparatus Committee 1901. We made them aware that we, due to science and our anthropometric work, had come up with new dimensions, requirements for seating, for firefighters to have enough room to safely sit down and put seatbelts on, and that there would have to be a dramatic increase in the size of a seat to accommodate a 2015 firefighter. We were, for all intents and purposes, basically ignored for some period of time until finally it came to a head last month in Chicago at this conference where my colleague, Gordon Ratley, put in a paper requesting a change in the standard to go from the current 22-inch of seat width at the hip to a more correct. Again, this is based on the science of body scanning and measuring 971 firefighters in the final study and then 200 firefighters before that, and then hand measuring another 780 firefighters in a study before that. So it's been something that we've been working on for over 10 years and can factually prove that it takes a minimum of 28 inches for a 2015 bunkered firefighter to properly sit down in a fire truck and have enough room to sit safely. And some people, particularly in the manufacturing sector, were confusing safety with comfort, that we just wanted to be more comfortable. And that wasn't the case at all. It had more to do with having enough room to properly sit down and put a seatbelt on. So a vote was taken, and in a vote of about 186-52, the standard was changed there. Our recommendation was approved that the apparatus industry would now indeed have to allow 28 inches at each seated position and figure out a way to do it. And there was a lot of banter about, oh, we can't do that. There's not enough room with the engine. And a friend of mine came back and said, this sounds like the discussion that happened in 1991 when the manufacturing sector was made by standard to make aerials that had a minimum of 250-pound tip load at any extension, any elevation, any angle that it was used on the fire ground. And as you can see, from that time period, just over 20 years later, a 250-pound tip load minimum at any elevation, any extension, any angle on the fire ground is now the national norm, and something that was almost heresy at the time to suggest is now just part of the national norm as it relates to building aerial devices. So I think many feel that this is going to be kind of what this change is going to mean. It's not something that the manufacturing sector, after having redesigned cabs for engines in 07 and in 09, are embracing, but it's something that needs to be done, and it will be done now based on the information that we have so far. And on another angle, we appealed last month for people in the greater Michigan area to take part in an aerial ladder study where we are taking and challenging the 14-inch rung spacing on an American aerial ladder and portable ladders with the feeling that there was no scientific derivation from where that number came from, and nobody can really explain where it came from. But the reality is, particularly for female firefighters and Asian firefighters that were part of our initial study, that if you put breathing apparatus, a saw, and bunker gear on them and ask them to climb up a ladder five or six stories to get the roof, by the time they get to the roof, they're an injury waiting to happen. And so as we were working with the anthropometric study with Hongwei and Jen, we asked the question, as a part two to this, with all the information that we've gathered so far, is there a way that you could scientifically tell us the exact number that it needs to be for a 2015 firefighter to be able to climb safely on an aerial ladder, and what that rung spacing number needs to be? And he assured us that we could, and so we embarked on this second part of the study, and it's at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, being run by Tom Armstrong, and he, in our last podcast, was seeking subjects to take part in the study on the endless ladder. And thank you, particularly to Chip Everett from Ostomo Township Fire Protection District outside of Grand Rapids, who rallied the brothers and sisters in the greater Michigan area. And so far, it looks like we have satisfied Tom Armstrong's numbers and types of individuals to take part in a ladder study. So we thank all our listeners for that in the greater Michigan area.
Well, wrapping up here, kind of somewhat of a fast-paced show, covered a lot of topical areas and things that we, that really concerning Mike and myself. And if you think about it for a moment, if we can unplug from the emotion of how we operate, what we're buying, you know, we're not Mike and I, as you say, we're brand neutral here. We don't care what brand of fire truck you buy. When we're looking at them, when we're involved, we get engaged, we're looking at it to make it the best, the safest possible vehicle that's going to integrate into how your department operates and how you deploy your units with whatever your staffing levels happen to be. But the underlying theme here, ladies and gentlemen, it's safety. It's about us. A lot of things look pretty good on paper. They may be even look pretty good as they're being built, or when you go for your final inspection and everybody's proud as a papa, as they say, when the new baby arrives in the town, and then you operate it a little bit and the sheen wears off, and particularly about the 14 or 15 month mark after the initial warranty's out, now the opinions really begin to come out, and that shine is new polish, so to speak, is worn off the unit, and now you realize you own this thing for the next anywhere from 12 to 15 years in most cases, and you may or may not be happy with the results. So careful planning, insightful discussions that are peaceful and rational, but everything needs to have a purpose, and most importantly, everything needs to be done with the impact of safety for the operating personnel that are going to drive, staff, and operate that vehicle. So for the apparatus architects, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, live here from the Firehouse Expo, Baltimore, Maryland. To everyone, be safe, take care.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.